welcome to an all-new Great Moments in Weed History. On this episode, we're going to jump in the Hotbox time machine and head all the way back to 2700 BC to hear the story of Magu, an ancient Chinese hemp goddess who lived on a mountaintop full of cannabis plants where she brewed the elixir of life. And doesn't that sound nice? My guides for this trip are Christina Wong and Wendy Zhang, two chefs, culinary cannabis creators, and the co-hosts of Mogu Magu, a culture, food, and cannabis collective exploring the Asian immigrant experience. Christina pitched me the idea for this episode when we were seated together at an industry breakfast in Las Vegas, and I gotta say, before the coffee arrived, I was pretty much all in. I've known Christina for a few years and greatly admire the writing and videos she produces under her fruit and flower banner, but it was the ancient history angle that captured my imagination. I hadn't met Wendy before this interview, but I knew she won Food Network's Chopped 420 cannabis cooking competition, which is pretty wild. When I co-created the Bon Appetit series on Vice back in 2014, a show where an Italian grandma made weed-buttered gnocchi was still considered really edgy. Food Network, meanwhile, is some shit my mom watches on the reg.
Yeah, I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge to better-looking people with better ideas and more talent. And we're actually really nice.
We all journey back into the distant past and meet Magu, the hemp goddess. I'd like to pause just briefly and ask you to all throw in a little something for the ride. Think of it this way. Over close to 150 episodes of this podcast, over more than 5 years' time, we've traveled tens of thousands of lit years of history together, lit years being like light years, but you know, you're stoned. Anyway, yes, the Hotbox time machine runs on hemp-based biomass and not harmful fossil fuels, but the old road trip adage still applies when it comes to gas money, and that is cash, grass, or hash. Nobody rides for free, and here's the thing, my friends, I've actually got plenty of hash and grass, so that just leaves cash, okay? So seriously, I'm only asking you to throw in, if you listen to this show on the reg, the way my mom watches Food Network, and I'm only asking for $1 a month, though, you know, more is more. And I'm only asking because I want to keep making this show, and the coffers have been a little light lately. So please, at least check out our Patreon at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com and see what you've been missing in terms of bonus content and secret seshes and whizzle wuzzles. And maybe you want to get a signed copy of my book or, you know, put five on it. Anyway, let's get ready to meet Magu. I've got a nice fatty J rolled up and ready, but wait, I'm hearing that you are saying, all right, I'm a little lit, but we're going back to 2700 BC. I got to be a lot more lit than I am lit already, and that's an easy problem. As you know, you could probably say it with me. All you got to do is hit pause and chill, and you can use that time at your leisure to roll yourself a joint or to split a blunt or to pack a bong or to endabulate a dab or to make yourself some nice hemp tea like the deity herself might do. Anyway, you slice it. When you hit unpause because you're lit and ready to roll, I promise you this, we'll all be lit and ready for another great moment in weed history. You know,
It's no exaggeration to say this podcast runs on coffee and weed. And lately, the coffee has been top shelf because of our new sponsor, Vigilante Coffee. I grind my beans daily, no pun intended, and I do the whole pretentious hipster pour over thing every morning, and I gotta say, I really enjoy thinking about where my coffee came from and how it was grown and processed, just like weed. And just like weed, it's worth it to get the best coffee you can afford. And the good news is, if you brew your own at home, really good coffee is an affordable luxury. That's why I'm thrilled to have Vigilante Coffee on the podcast and in my mug each and every morning. Vigilante is a specialty coffee roaster that sources their beans directly from small, award-winning farms around the world and then roasts them to perfection. They support ending the war on drugs, and they want to support this podcast too because they believe that all you really need is coffee and weed. Amen. So treat yourself to a bag of their Golden Bean Award-winning Dank blend, which has just returned for its fourth year. Dank is 80% Guatemalan and 20% Ethiopian. Brew that up nice and strong and pair it with a puff or two of good weed in the morning, and I guarantee you will be up and at them. To learn more or to order their amazing coffee, check out their website, vigilantecoffee.com, or you can visit one of their cafes. And if you buy a pound of those beans, well, please tell them Beans sent you. VigilanteCoffee.com.
Hey, Christina and Wendy, welcome to you both to Great Moments in Weed History.
Hey, David, thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Well, we have a big historical topic to discuss on this weeds episode, but I want to start by asking you the question I ask pretty much every guest at the top of the show to set your weed journey by letting us know the first time you encountered this plant.
Oh man, I guess I'll start. My first encounter was in high school, and I was dumb and I didn't know anything, but I was friends with all the stoners at the rival high school. And of course, my crush was there and all these cute guys, and they were always smoking. And I didn't really partake myself. But one time at one party, I was like, okay, I'll try it. I trust my friends. And that led to me not touching cannabis for maybe the next 20 years of my life because I was dumb and I had a huge bong rip and I was throwing up for like at least 5 hours. And so that scared me. And my thought was like, okay, this isn't for me. My body doesn't agree with it. I will just stay away from it. And it wasn't until I got a job in the industry and it was newly legal that I had safe access and people to teach me and give me product and teach me moderation that I suddenly felt comfortable again. And then when Wendy and I met and we started getting high and just consuming and eating great food and talking, like these magical things started happening and unfolding for us.
Well, I'll just quickly interject and say I can personally still picture the purple plastic graphics bong that did me harm the first time I ever took a bong hit, and I can close my eyes and see that little Joker logo haunting my nightmares that night. Wendy, was it love at first toke or was it a rocky road?
I would say it was probably love at first toke. Similarly to Christina, it was also boy crush incentivized. I never heard Christina articulate the story, so I didn't realize that like both of us were like, you know, crushing on these stoner boys. There was this guy in my art class. Some people nicknamed him the Muffin Man because he would make wee muffins to bring to the school. And I just, you know, thought he was so cute. And one day after school, you know, we were hanging out and he showed me how to smoke out of a pipe. So I think maybe that's why it wasn't like as intense, because I just got a little bit of a head change and it gave me the THC courage to like give this crush a kiss. And so it was like a little bit of that awkward high kind of kiss, but it was still mostly pleasant. So I had a pretty good pleasant intro to cannabis. And since then, I have always consumed throughout college. And I didn't really think about having a career in cannabis, but I definitely thought about having a career in culinary arts. So I was hosting dinners because that's kind of how I grew up too, is, you know, going to family dinners every weekend. And when me and my family moved and emigrated from China to the US, we kept that tradition alive. So just always seeing that my family bringing each other and communities together through food, it's something I just, you know, was not naturally modeling after. And then when you interject cannabis in there, you know, it's just a even more magical vibe, because the plant has such an amazing ability to lower our ego and create even more meaningful connections and uncover new truths. So it was just a match made in heaven that I started not only doing just these dinner pop-ups, but doing like weed infused pop-ups.
Right on. Well, I gotta say, Wendy, I think that you and weed had a meet cute, is how I would
say. A meet cute. That's adorable.
When do these two stories intersect? How did you come into each other's orbit, and what came out of that connection that you made?
We met on Instagram, actually. I was chef crushing on Wendy. We were both invited to participate in this cannabis chef cook-off, a virtual cook-off on Instagram. And Wendy had previously won her round before, and then I was competing. And I was looking at all the other people who had won before, and she was one of them, Hejin, Big Bad Wolf, and Monica Lowe, Sue Weed. And I was like, who are these badass Asian women, like just kicking ass at like culinary cannabis? And the cool thing was, because of that, it connected all of us and we became friends. And Wendy and I just also happened to live near each other in Los Angeles, which is the holy grail of friendships, because LA's so big, you want friends who live nearby. And so we just started hanging out and just getting high and eating hella good food. And then like just everything just started pouring out, and the emotions and the connections, and like Mogu Magu was born.
We really supported each other through these sesh where we eat a lot of really great food, unpacked a lot of our family trauma and our relationship with people in our lives and relationship with work, money, all of the things that really needed to be re-examined. We did that together. And it was so beautiful to go through this journey with Christina from a perspective of being a Asian immigrant woman, or being first gen, you know, we have very different backgrounds, but also a lot of shared experiences.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about that. You know, we're going to tell a story in this episode about sort of the deep history of the cannabis plant in Asia, as a medicine, as part of folklore, as, you know, everything that we look to the plant for now. You know, there's also certainly a lot of stigma around the plant currently, you know, for everyone, but perhaps particularly for Asian communities. I see a lot of activism in those communities trying to shut down dispensaries in California, as one example. So can you talk about how you see that, and you know, very positively, how you're working to change that?
What you're referring to, David, was that in San Francisco, in Chinatown, there's a lot of elderly Chinese in the community, and they were protesting any new dispensaries opening specifically in that Chinatown area and in their neighborhoods. And they're septa and octogenarians who go to church, and they're being bussed in by churches with signs, and they're protesting cannabis dispensary openings. And the message is, because it's bad for the community, it's bad for us, it's bad for our youth, it's bad for our children, protect our children. And Wendy and a couple of our AAPI friends who work in the cannabis space were interviewed and featured in the South China Morning Post. And that is one of the largest, most widely read, I think the largest read publication in Southern China. It's huge. And she was featured, plus everybody else, talking about, hey, like, we're young, modern, sort of like, it's legal now. It's not bad. This is a part of our history. And really, like, being in this publication, an article showing Asian faces and successful people and individuals consuming cannabis and explaining why this isn't evil and horrible and bad is really important. And that's not being shown enough. Cannabis has been demonized. There's so much stigma in our community. And even still, like, we think about people who are sentenced to life in prison, to death for possessing cannabis or having anything, even CBD. And here we get the privilege of consuming daily and being able to make a living and to educate about this plant.
What was the most interesting kind of email or phone call or text you got related to that article coming out?
When the article came out, it was really a cool story, you know, that I got to tell, because there was that macrocosm of what Christina just talked about, what was happening at a larger scale within the Asian community. But there was also in the microcosm of my family where this was happening. You know, when I won CHOP 420, you know, it was very publicized. So I ended up just being very honest and transparent with my parents about my involvement in the industry. And I knew that there would be a lot of stigma and propaganda that they have already bought into by just us growing up in China. And like, modern China is not very pro-cannabis at all, you know, in fact, very anti. So I knew I had to overcome a lot of misinformation. And unfortunately, like, my mom, she was not very receptive at all. But my dad, he was, you know, and it's not even like, oh, he knew so much about cannabis already. But he has always taken more of a scientific research perspective to understanding any new topics. So he actually went and read a bunch of research papers across different universities and was like, hey, just so you know, I don't have a problem with this, because I'm learning and reading about how there's actually a lot of benefits to this plan, you know, to so many people's lives, and that there is still so much more research to be had. Whereas my mom, she kind of just refused to listen to any new research. You know, I could just see how much fear-based thinking there was. So I'm just trying not to be so held up on the outcome of her accepting these things, but continuing to show up and do what I do. And it just, if anything, that lights more of a fire under my ass to make this kind of information more accessible to the Asian community, to reclaim our birthright to this plan, because it is actually founded and has its roots in China.
And I think Wendy and I both met at a time in our lives where, like, we were both going through a lot of growth, and we found the healing presence of cannabis. It healed us. It continues to heal us. And just sitting and being high and having these conversations and sharing these comforting, familiar meals was profound. And so we said, we're like, well, how do we do this with more people? And how do we invite more friends? And so we just invited friends over for Hot Pot. And that turned into a big thing.
Was that a weed pun? Can't let them slide by on this program. I'm not pun shaming you. This is the water we swim in here.
We put the pot in the hot pot.
Yes.
But the beauty of that was, like, we realized, we're like, oh, wow, like, we're combining cannabis and our culture and food in a way that people haven't seen before. And so that led us into creating Mogu Magu, an AAPI culture, food, and cannabis collective. We discovered a Taoist deity of hemp, and we're like, what is this? Who is Magu, and who is this character? And we really just started pulling at the thread and became obsessed. And we found that we're like, holy crap, our Asian culture has a deity, a goddess, who celebrates hemp and is celebrated for longevity and as a protector of women. And she's celebrated for healing all of Asia. How do we, as modern Asian American immigrants, learn from this story, learn from Magu and these stories that were told about her, to reclaim cannabis as part of our healing journeys and to help others along the way?
Well, we're gonna have to jump in the old hot box time machine and head very far back, pretty much as far back almost as I think we've ever taken the hot box time machine on this show. But I want to interject one thought
Wendy, I just want to thank you for sharing very personal things. And I think it resonates with a lot of people who have had that dynamic. And I just want to share that my own mother certainly began to change her views pretty radically about cannabis when it became my job and means of supporting myself. So that definitely helped. But it was only just very recently that I was able to, in essence, without divulging anything on anyone else's behalf, but someone in my family needed medical cannabis, and I was able to go with my mom and be the conduit to the plant and have her see firsthand how helpful and medicinal this plant can be. And I just say this, I say this very often on this program in different contexts. One, don't ever give up on your family members. You don't have to have this same conversation over and over again, but you have to keep it in play because they will someday need it as a medicine. And you just want to be as far along in that conversation as you can. And two, don't ever be shy or hesitant to be that person for somebody who may need access to this plant medicinally. Just showing up with the plant or a gummy or whatever you think is going to work best is, you know, a huge thing that you can do to help somebody. And you just don't ever want to look back and think, I should have spoken up, you know. And the only other thing I can say, Wendy, you know, just being, I've had parents a lot longer than you have, let me put it that way, is consistency goes a long way. When somebody realizes that you feel and believe the same things 5 years later, 10 years later, 20 years later, they're just going to see it a different way. That all said, how far back are we? I will say one thing. I know there's a lot of scholarship that believes perhaps the first cannabis plant ever is indigenous to what would be modern day China. But how far back can we go in telling this story?
We are going to go all the way back to 2737 BC. So the emperor of China at the time was written in scholarly texts that he had recommended cannabis tea for treating gout, rheumatism, malaria, and poor memory. And then before that, they even found symbolic writings from an emperor around like 2800 BC that created the first Chinese letter for hemp. And it's a pictograph that looks like two cannabis plants or hemp plants hanging upside down underneath the roof. And that is the character Ma. And that is the same character that shows up in Ma Gu's name. So Ma and Gu means aunt or maiden. So she is the hemp maiden or hemp auntie, which is really how Wendy and I see ourselves. We're the weed aunties.
Wow. Well, first I have to say, so the symbol is the plants hanging upside down from a roof. So that is very evocative to me, and I know to a lot of people, of cannabis drying. You know, when I've been on farms at harvest time in Humboldt County, there's pretty much a cannabis plant hanging to dry anywhere that there's space. And, you know, that shows a sophistication about the preparation of the plant. You're viewing a plant very differently if you're looking at it as, oh, this is a plant that grows in the ground versus this is something that we carefully harvest and hang and dry. And then I did want to say, I do believe the emperor may have been 3 for 4 out of those medicinal uses of cannabis. Can you run them back for me one at a time?
It was gout.
Check.
Rheumatisms.
Definitely.
Malaria.
Yep.
And poor memory.
I don't know that cannabis fixes.
Well, I depends on the strain.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Who knows what kind of fire they had back then? Weed's so good, you remember stuff, where your keys are and, you know, what keys are. So Well, this is fascinating. When did you first kind of get on the trail of this story, and where did you seek out more information?
We were just having a gathering with our other peer weed aunties who are also of Asian backgrounds, you know, and I think this character just came up in conversation. And then we were like, well, we got to look into this. And the more we read about this figure, which, you know, there's a lot of divergent stories within that too. You know, she is the goddess of longevity. So there's definitely this, you know, this emphasis on elixirs and plant medicine kind of helping to keep the longevity and the youthfulness of somebody. And so we dug a little deeper of like, well, where deities, usually deities come in sets, you know, when you think about like Roman Greek mythology, all those deities comes in like a whole slew of people. So Magu is no different. There's a lot of deities within Taoism. And what was cool is Magu led us down this path of understanding Taoism even more, you know, and that was, and I started learning parts of my culture that I have never known before that I felt such resonance with. Growing up in China, I always felt like it was so patriarchal and did not uphold feminist values. And it was just a little bit of a disconnect between me and my culture. And so it was so wonderful that Magu led us down this path where I was discovering parts of my culture that actually celebrated women's contribution to society, that celebrated women's ability to be in nature and be, you know, so in tune with nature that she's using the plants that she forages on this ancient magical mountain to heal the sick and the poor. Go figure, right? Go like through cannabis, it's leading us down to these really wonderful values that are just waiting for us to kind of reclaim and rediscover about our own culture.
And we went down this path because we were Googling and looking for information, and it's just all over the place. There's, you know, people are writing, there's some historical texts that are cited. I mean, but again, everything is hearsay. And so we asked a friend, we're like, hey, she's an expert in East Asian art and artifacts. And we're like, hey, would you go down this path with us? And can we go through and find Magu through ancient Asian art and see like, what can we find? What are the themes that we see? And so we did that, and we turned that into a salon and art exhibition. And what we realized was there was all this really beautiful art depicting Magu and as a goddess, also in her mortal life as well, that tells her story. And we very clearly see in the background, the hemp plant is very much featured. She is often carrying flowers and fungus and plants that she harvested, foraged from the mountain to bring down to brew and make elixirs of life and potion. And what we found happened was there was a lot of this really beautiful art and storytelling, mostly in China, but she also shows up in Japan, in Korean, and also Vietnamese mythology and history as well. We found all these beautiful depictions and art of Magu in ancient times. But then what happened was in 1966, China had a cultural revolution that wiped out most of the traces of Magu, destroyed all the shrines and the temples that worshipped her, and only one survived. So looking at all of the past stories and depictions, there's not a lot. And the ones that were created were mostly through male scholars and the male gaze. And so there haven't been new art and new stories through a feminine gaze. And so that's what led us into creating this and wanting to know more about Magu.
So in Chinese, you actually don't, like, a lot of people don't really distinguish between cannabis and like actually harmful drugs. Everything is just called drugs or poison. Like the direct translation of smoking weed is to xi du, which means inhale poison. So when you grow up with that kind of language, it really creates this like such a deep fear of the plant.
Yeah, I think the interesting thing when you look at cannabis prohibition, the history of it from a global perspective, you have governments and authorities of every ideological bent severely
prohibiting a plant that is clearly medicinal, that is clearly beneficial. In the United States, there's a deep history of racism to that, but that is not the case everywhere there is cannabis prohibition. In very homogenized societies, you see very intense cannabis prohibition. You see it in fascist governments. You see it in communist governments. You see it in hyper-capitalistic governments. You see it in dictatorships. And I think the common thread is that this plant causes people to question authority. And if you are in authority over people, that is not something that you want. And in particular, when you're abusing that authority, because if you were doing a good job of being the authorities and people smoked some weed and were like, oh, what's the government doing? And they were like, oh, government's taking care of people's welfare and providing for a just and equitable society. I don't think they'd be so upset about it. And going along with that is this need to erase the history of cannabis, because this plant has so clearly been an ally to humanity since the dawn of time, predating history. And so that all has to be erased. And in the case of these destroyed temples and holy places and artwork, quite literally destroyed. But I believe hear that one temple site to this day still exists, and I would love to know more about that site.
What you're saying is absolutely correct, and why we are trying to retell Magu's story is because we forgot how important this plant was in our history, in our culture. Hemp was the most common fabric of the time. That was the fabric of the commoners. Silk was for royalty. Silk is expensive. Hemp is very affordable and easy and fast to grow. And so in China, a lot of this hemp was purported to grow on Mount Tai, which is where Magu is often depicted. Mount Tai is one of the largest mountains in China, and it supposedly connects the heavens and the earth. And it's one of the five sacred mountains in Taoism. And so there is the one remaining temple to Magu. And it's called like Magu Mountain. You can see a review of it on TripAdvisor. But that was supposedly the place where Magu came down from the mountain in the heavens and brewed the elixir of life. And so you can still go there. There's a lake and a little statue of her. And fishing and hunting are prohibited in that area because they said that Magu did not want to see others being cruelly killed or injured. Wendy and I have been talking about, we're like, we'd love to do an excursion there and go check it out.
And David, just to circle back on the excellent point you made about like the different expressions of prohibition based on, you know, different political regimes, it may be different expressions, but there's that common thread. And that's, I think, exactly why Taoism is not as touted and like passed along and amplified the way that, say, Confucianism was. Because, you know, as I was digging into this wonderful way of thinking, and I was like, this is so cool. How come we are hiding this rich art and people-oriented, feminist-valued part of our history in favor of this, you know, very patriarchal one that I do not resonate with? And, you know, and then here, and then all of a sudden it becomes so clear, it's because Taoism preaches about decentralizing power, you know, and whereas Confucianism is all about the centralizing of power, especially within the male leader of the family or the unit or the community or the country.
This is far from the first episode of this podcast where we've talked about cannabis and spirituality in the ancient world. And just as prohibition comes from many different angles, we have discussion of cannabis in the Hindu tradition through Shiva, among other stories found in those ancient texts. There's an entire episode of our podcast about cannabis in the ancient world through the Judaic tradition and later a separate episode about, and just don't at me, just listen to the episode. If you're going to at me, you got to listen to the episode first about Jesus and cannabis. And, you know, central in all of these stories is, I think, another aspect of this, which is, you know, when we're talking about spiritual authorities, when we're talking about religious authorities, we're talking about dogma and a hierarchical system put in place to manage your spiritual experience. And what's pretty common with cannabis as an aid to spirituality is that it engenders a direct connection. There's this saying, don't confuse the finger pointing at the moon for the moon. If we think of our spiritual connection as the moon in this analogy, cannabis allows us to look right at the moon and not to have that experience middlemaned and interpreted for us by clergy and text and hierarchical organizations and sort of ingrained traditions. And that's frightening to the authorities that want to, in essence, these are the views of me myself. By the way, I guess as I'm speaking, like, of course everyone sees the world the way I do, not implying that. And you're free to weigh in or just let this one pass. But this is my own sort of a view of it, and I think it's something that people, you know, lots of people smoke weed and they like it, and it makes them hungry and it makes them laugh, and they go on about their business, and that's great, and it'll be there for them when they need it as a medicine. But the people who listen to this show and the people who are guests on this show, something about this plant really called to us deeply. Mm-hmm. And I think that it always has a spiritual element, however you define that word. And so what is in China or elsewhere, are there people still actively, I don't know if worshiping is the right word. What is the current state of play for nothing I say is going out how I want it to sound.
Like how does Magu show up today still in modern age? Got you.
Yes.
You know, I'm actually curious. I would like to know more as a Asian American who grew up here. I don't have a lot of information. I would love to know more. And part of this exploration is we get to piece it together. I think, like, what I've seen is that Magu is often there for, like, birthday wishes, because she's known as, like, the protector of women and a celebration of longevity. So it's like, you know, Magu sends you birthday wishes and wishes you a long life. But all traces, anything I see about Magu in, like, modern Asia, the cannabis is really erased.
Yeah, I think we definitely are privileged being over here, because even me being a immigrant right now, so me and my family moved here when I was like 10. Even now, I always have this fear. I mean, I mostly ignore it, but the fear is real because the threat is real. Anybody saying something negative about the Chinese government or anything that's not part of what they want to promote, like, you do have this real threat of, you know, being disappeared. Like, that's how it was explained to me since I was a kid, and that, like, hey, don't say certain things out loud in public because you're going to get made disappear. So it is a very real thing, and it's something I have to navigate and do mental gymnastic on all the time of being an advocate, you know, knowing I do travel there and that I do want to uncover these things. But that threat of even worshiping or researching or uncovering some of these history comes with its own risk. We would love to know, and hopefully whoever's listening to this podcast will reach out and, like, share their knowledge on it. I think Christina and I come from a place of, like, the more we talk about it, the more we do bring it back to life. But I think there is a real threat to people actually openly worshiping or promoting Magu or anything cannabis related, that people just don't do it, or at least not in public, you know, and not publicly enough where it's documented digitally that we can have access to. I think that's why we you know, are curious about going to the mountain. Like, I think it's going to take more of that on the ground research to really tap into, are there people who are researching this? Are there people keeping this alive? Because it is still such a taboo that comes with real threat and risk.
We'll have to check our download numbers for Mount Tai. If you are out there, first of all, please don't do anything that's going to expose you to any risk or harm beyond, you know, this podcast will self-destruct as soon as you are done listening to it. But more seriously, I really hope that that is a journey that you can both make physically to that site. And I really appreciate the journey you've taken us all on today in telling this story and sharing this story. I know it's going to resonate with a lot of people. Before we leave this beautiful ancient world of cannabis tranquility, take me on the full journey with Magu. Take me back to that time.
My favorite story of Magu starts with her mortal life and her as a woman. So Magu lived with her father, who was, I think, a blacksmith or worked with horses. And one day she was given a peach by one of her clients. And when she went home, instead of sharing it with her father, she saw an old, poor, elderly woman on the street. And so she gave the woman the peach and said that, hang on, let me go home and make you some food. So she went home and started opening their cupboards and made food from their kitchen to bring to her. But before she could go back to find the old woman on the side of the street, her father came home, saw that she was giving away their food and had given away a peach, and punished her and locked her in her room. And so by the time she was able to escape her room and go find the old woman again, the woman was gone. And all that was left was the peach stone. And so she took this peach stone and planted it in the middle of her village and cared for it as it grew into this vibrant peach tree that then she gave away the fruits freely to feed those in need. And eventually, people would say that these peaches were healing. And then because of her generosity, because of that, because she remembered to that tiny act of kindness and generosity to take care of somebody else elevated her and immortalized her as a goddess that possessed the elixir of life. There was a scholar who wrote about Magu as well, who came to go visit on the seventh day of the seventh month at Mount Tai, which is said that was when the hemp harvest was supposedly happening, and that's still celebrated now, I hear. So he invited Magu to come down from the heavens and join them for this feast, for the celebration, and that she came down and she had foraged all of these plants and herbs and flowers and fungus from Mount Tai and brewed the elixir of immortality. And it was said that the elixir was from the celestial kitchens and it was unfit for drinking by ordinary people. So they watered it down and they diluted it and everybody drank some and they were intoxicated and wanted more. And the story kind of ends there, but it's really about her brewing this elixir of life from the celestial kitchens. And so I like to joke and I'm like, was Magu the first one to make a cannabis beverage?
Yeah, you got to water it down to 10 milligrams of THC per earthenware cup.
So her elixir of life has been depicted as something that she brewed and she concocted on this big fire at the base of the mountain in the celestial kitchens. And so it's like all these pieces kind of come together. And what Wendy and I really found the most pertinent about Magu's story and why we resonate with it so much is that as women, as cannabis consuming women who are healers, right? We cook food, we heal people through plants and food and culture and gathering and togetherness. And that's so much what Magu embodies. And so really rediscovering her story, looking back at who she was and what was depicted, it's more about how do we heal ourselves through Magu? What Wendy was saying earlier about this fear that she has, right? That like something bad will happen. Like I grew up here, so I'm very American. I don't have that fear. My parents have that fear, but it's my intergenerational trauma to carry because I hear it. I hear their voices. And through these exercises, through these conversations, through intentional cannabis consumptions, we can begin to recognize these stories and heal ourselves.
That's beautiful. And it's really full circle. It's full circle in your own, you know, and let's face it, we have cute boys to thank, right?
Like where all things start.
Well, you've certainly, left, I assume, those particular gentlemen are far in the past, and cannabis is the future, the female plant, indigenous to Asia, and may it return to prominence there. And everywhere else. I do often like to ask guests to leave us with a great moment from their own personal weed history. I think we could probably do a whole other episode on the Chopped 420 victory, but I'd love to leave with a great moment in your weed friendship, because, you know, we're all about history here, but we really like to talk about weed friendships and weed crews. And I'm wondering if there's a great moment that you share, Wendy, maybe that you could leave us with.
Man, it's so hard to pick one.
Can we talk about your dad?
Yeah, actually, that was very healing. So, I mean, in general, our Mogu Magu gatherings are so healing because I've never had Asian friends like this. So all of our gatherings are so magical to me because I'm finally seeing a community who look like me, who actually reflect my values and how I want to live life. But what was really cool was this past year in 2023, Christina and I produced this art exhibit with our friend who's a East Asian art expert. And I did not expect my dad to be down to come, but he was already visiting me during my birthday. And I was like, hey, do you want to stay an extra couple of days? It's because I'm putting on this event. It would be cool if you can come check it out. Because I think that, you know, as much as I can describe to him or describe to anybody what we're doing, you don't really get it until you are there, because those visuals, that experience is something that doesn't exist. It's so unique what we put on together. And it's not even just us that's making it unique. It's that community coming together that's unique. This event at the Astor Hotel was in the middle of Hollywood. It's this beautiful members only like hotel. And you walk into this beautiful lounge room full of very artistic furniture, very vibey, and plants everywhere. And we also had life-size cutouts from this Magu photo series that I helped to creatively produce. And it was basically taking an inspo from those scholar scrolls, where you often see male scholars imbibing in the garden. It's just like a big trope in East Asian art. So we wanted to turn that upside down on its head and have a female photographer depict us as modern Magus smoking weed and imbibing in the garden, but all having our own expertise. So like, for example, I was cooking with a wok, but there was this like billow of smoke bomb coming out of it. So it's very fantastical, very modern, very edgy. And when you walk in, there's, just the like coolest creative Asians. And then there was a grilling of food and really tasty mushrooms and duck and all kinds of sauces. And then there were people, kind of smoking in different enclaves that we created. There was Mindy 420 who did the cannabis-inspired henna. So it's just a visual eye trip. Oh, and also tea ceremony was happening too. There's mushroom teas, but there's also like non-dosed, really high-end premium teas from our friends at Standstill who did like tea ceremony for everybody. So it's just like you go to all these different booths to experience Asian culture and you see cannabis and sometimes also mushrooms very seamlessly integrated in these cultural practices. And you know, it was so cool for me, I think also for my dad, because in that moment, I think for him, he saw that this is the American dream. You know, it doesn't have to look like your Asian kid being a doctor, a lawyer, or whatever. And it could look like your immigrant daughter is changing culture. It's pushing American culture along because we're not on the fringes. We're ingrained and we're creating new narratives and we can be at the forefront. And so I think it was really cool for me to have my dad witness me doing that and fully seeing me in that light. And it was also cool for me to take care of him at the end of the night because he accidentally overdosed himself on some mooncakes. So we had these like marijuana mooncakes that were served alongside the tea ceremony. And, you know, I think something so familial like a mooncake, he just didn't think twice about it. And he was just like, oh yeah, of course I'm going to eat like this whole thing.
He was told multiple times not to eat it. Do not eat this. This contains cannabis. And he's like, doi, doi, doi.
Yeah, he's like, right, right. Okay, I'm not going to do it.
This is how it always tumbles out. You know, because I was going to say that because it's, and this is not related to your father specifically, but because it's based on nothing, like all this stigma, all this oppression, all these laws, all this, you know, effort to eradicate this plant, because there's no underpinning to it. It's not even like, you know, I firmly believe all drugs should be legalized. But some of them are clearly very dangerous and harmful. And yeah, cannabis can be, you know. But what I'm saying is, once people are like, oh, okay, they're just like, yeah, I'll eat a moon pot. Like, there's no in between because it was never a real thing. Tell me that you know, he got through the experience okay.
Oh, yeah. No, he was fine. And I think it was cool for him to see how I show up for people in those moments. Because, I mean, let's be honest, we've all been there, you know? I, even though, like, the first time I smoked weed, it was fine, there's definitely been times when I overdosed myself when I made edibles, because edibles and smokables have completely different effects on the body.
For me, as an observer of all of this going down, it was hysterical, because I just see her dad, like, sitting in the corner, staring at the student glass, because we were making smoked cocktails, and he's just sitting there staring, and then we get home, we're like on our way home, and I just get a text from Wendy and we're just going back and forth. He's like, my dad, we're like, what did he eat? What happened? We're trying to like figure it out backwards. And it turns out he ate like more than half or three quarters of the mooncake because it was just too delicious. And the whole thing was 40 milligrams. I was like, oh no, that's just way too much. But he was such a champ. And like, also like for me, like knowing Wendy's story, being friends and like having, you know, really heard this really very real raw emotional part of her, you know, of her life, like, and her relationship with her father and her mom, it makes me brave to want to have these conversations with my parents. And so to see her dad come and come to our event and to sit there and watch his face as he was watching Wendy speak to this amazing group of people, as his daughter, as this woman of power with like just such clarity of who she is. And then for him to finally feel comfortable enough to be like, I am knowingly eating this mooncake and going through this experience, and her being brave to have this with her father inspires me to have that with my parents. And like, I gifted my mom weed tea for Christmas. And for the first time, she was actually really stoked about it. Like, and to bring it around, like you said earlier, like, you know, don't be afraid to have these conversations with people. Also, don't give up on the people. Leave room for them to surprise you. Because when I first started, my parents were like, oh, I don't know. And they're still a little hesitant, but like, They have come so far, and I'm so proud of them. And I'm proud of you, Wendy.
Thank you. I have you to thank for, you know, always being such a supportive friend in my corner. You know, I just really felt like, you know, in that moment of deciding, am I going to come out of the wee closet to them or not? I'm like, how can I fully call myself like an advocate for this plant if I'm still in the closet about it? You know, I'm really, really grateful for the people who see the work I do and continue to show up for me, like Christina. So, you know, thanks, girl.
Well, I want to thank you both one more time for sharing your personal stories, for sharing this very ancient story, and especially now that I know that everyone made it through that experience intact, I'm going to get my stamp that says Great Moment in Weed History, and I'm going to officially designate that. I'm sorry, was it moon cake?
Mooncakes, yeah. We eat them for Mid-Autumn Festival, symbolizing togetherness with family.
Well, it certainly did that and much more. And I'm going to designate that mooncake moment and the whole event that you put on and your whole journey in recovering this very fascinating, very important history of cannabis as a great moment in weed history. And thank you all for listening. We will see you next Weedness Day for another episode. And until then, please stay high, healthy, and happy.
Well, that's the show, folks. Thanks so much for listening. And if you stuck around this long, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You could put five on it at greatmomentsinweedhistory.com. And that would really help us as we research, write, edit, and publish a new episode every Weedness Day. Great Moments in Weed History is written, produced, and performed by me, David Bienenstock, a.k.a. Bean. Special thanks to our sponsor, PAX. Go to PAX.com and use promo code GREATMOMENTS, all one word, for a big discount at checkout.